Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, we offer a glimpse into the life of Impressionist master Claude Monet. Reclusive, reticent, and temperamental, known for taking a knife to some of his canvases when frustration reached the boiling point, Monet in his later years was obsessed with capturing quickly changing elements of color and light in the garden at his home in the charming French town of Giverny. It was a time in which World War I was unfolding, and it was also the era in which Monet created The Grand Decoration, a series of enormous panels depicting scenes in large part from his Water Lily Garden, a tremendous work which he later and somewhat reluctantly gifted to France. Well, author Ross King is with us in studio to give us a more textured look into this period in Monet's life. King writes about it in his newest book, Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. Ross King, welcome back to Radio Times.
Thanks, Mary. It's great to be back.
So to start, let's get an impression of who Monet was. He'd throw these enormous and very rich lunches at his home in Giverny. If you or I were lucky enough to have been invited as a guest to one of these events, what would we have seen in his personality and also in his physical presence?
Well, lunch chez Claude Monet in Giverny was one of the most coveted invitations in France for the better part of 25 or 30 years. One thing I'll ask everyone to do as they listen today is to banish from their mind any thought of Claude Monet as a starving artist, because really by the 1890s, when he was in his 50s, he was very wealthy. His paintings sold for large amounts of money, so he could live the good life, and he loved the good life. He loved the good life when he was poor, which got him into a certain amount of debt, but he loved it especially when he could afford it. And so he had this beautiful home in Giverny, to the northwest of Paris in the Seine Valley, that he had sort of created in his own image. And so if you got this invitation to Giverny, a car would come and pick you up from a rail station. You'd be driven through the country lanes. You would arrive in Giverny, and there would Monet and his stepdaughter, who I write about, Blanche, would his stepdaughter slash daughter-in-law, because she was a stepdaughter who married his biological son. And so Blanche and Monet would greet you, and you would then sit down to the table, and you'd have this wonderful meal that was dished up often by a butler wearing white gloves. The food was lovingly prepared by Monet's personal chef, a woman named Marguerite, who was with him for decades. You got the best food at France at his table, apparently.
What was he like as a host? What was his personality like and his physical presence?
He didn't talk a lot, even among very close friends of his. He watched. He was an observer. Everyone commented on his eyes. And in fact, it was speculated in the 1880s and 1890s that Monet saw differently from the rest of humanity, and that he was sensitive to colors, extra sensitive to colors at the ultraviolet end of the spectrum. And so he could see things in nature that mere mortals could not. And he, whether that was true or not, who knows? But I'm not sure if anyone is like that. But I think it underlines the point that he was a great observer of nature, but he was also an observer of people. And so he would invite people to his table. And he wasn't a brilliant conversationalist. He was widely read and he was very intelligent, but he didn't hold forth a lot on topics, even with people such as Georges Clemenceau, who was his great friend, the man who was twice Prime Minister of France. He would sort of answer in one or two word sentences, and yet he wasn't taciturn for the most part. His eyes sparkled. He enjoyed the company. He enjoyed the wine and the food and all of that. But he just was not someone who was particularly garrulous. But he was a great host. He would always top up your glass of wine, top up his own as well. And then afterwards, if you were very lucky, you would get a tour of the gardens. So you'd go out. Monet always said lunch first. So he would give you this fantastic meal. And then he would take you out, hopefully into the sunshine, and you could see the garden immediately behind the house. And then also, of course, you would then cross a railway track and a road, and you'd be in what was known as the Domain of the Water Lilies, which is where, from between 1893 and 1903, he constructed his water lily pond and began, and then in 1903 began painting it. really incessantly worked on it for the rest of his life.
Let's go back just a little bit to the salad days of the young artist. If you could read us a passage from your book.
Sure. Well, I asked you to banish from your mind the idea of Monet as a starving artist, but here he is in his youth as a starving artist. Monet's early years as a painter occasionally featured irate landlords and shopkeepers, out-of-pocket friends, and enforced economies. For the past 8 days, he lamented in 1869 when he was 29 years old, I've had no bread, no wine, no fire for the kitchen, and no light. That same year, he claimed to have no money to buy paints, and bailiffs seized four of his paintings from the walls of an exhibition to settle his numerous debts. Over the next decade, his canvases sometimes went for as little as 20 francs each, at a time when a blank canvas cost 4 francs. He was once forced to give paintings to a baker in return for bread. A draper proved impossible to appease. His laundress sequestered his bedsheets when he failed to pay her bill. If I don't come up with 600 francs by tomorrow night, he wrote to a friend in 1877, my furniture and all I own will be sold and will be thrown into the street. When a butcher sent round the bailiffs to impound his possessions, Monet vengefully slashed 200 of his canvases. He once, so the legend went, spent an entire winter living on potatoes. Monet often exaggerated his plight. Even in the early days, his paintings had sometimes attracted astute collectors and fetched respectable prices. In 1868, the esteemed critic Arsène Houssaye paid 800 francs for one of his paintings, enough to pay the rent on a house for an entire year. Moreover, his privations were offset by generous friends. The painter Frédéric Basile, the novelist Émile Zola, a pastry chef and novelist named Eugène Muret, and Dr. Paul Gachet, who would later have on his hands another frustrated and even more impecunious artist, Vincent van Gogh. All of them over the years received begging letters detailing Monet's allegedly precarious financial state and his miserable prospects. In 1878, aged 38, he lamented to another benefactor, Georges de Beaulieu, a homeopath, it's sad to be in such a situation at my age, always obliged to ask for favors. Then a few months later, he wrote, I'm absolutely disgusted and demoralized by this existence that I've led for such a long time. Each day brings new sorrows and new difficulties from which I'll never extricate myself.
And of course, as you said earlier in our conversation, he rather successfully extricated himself.
Exactly. Within a decade or so. He did have, I suppose, 20 somewhat difficult years where he was constantly writing begging letters to friends and patrons and people like that. But ultimately, yes, he became very wealthy.
So at times his work was celebrated, and at times, especially early on, it wasn't. You write of one time, I guess, which he shows his work with a group that includes Renoir and Degas and Cézanne, and one of his seascapes was denounced as less skillful than crude wallpaper.
That's right. Yes, and that painting is one of the paintings that gave the Impressionists their name, because he, in 1874, with this group of friends, showed a work called Impression Sunrise, which is a view of the Normandy coast. And not a lot of is happening in the painting. We see the ships at sea, we see the sun coming up, etc. And Monet just said it's an impression. He didn't have a great title for it. And that was then mocked in the press by who said these are not painters, they're impressionists. And so the term impressionist was originally a pejorative term, but ultimately within a couple of years the painters embraced the name, and of course that's their immortality has been won over or won under that name.
Well, even if the impression in quotes is one of, say, spontaneity, you write that de Monet's painting technique required a good deal of forethought and groundwork. How do you mean?
Well, if Monet were conducting this interview, he would say all he did was went out in sunshine or in all weathers, in fact, and nature was his studio, and he put his impressions down on canvas, and you would come away with the impression that he spent a couple of hours on a painting, but in fact, he spent much, much more time. He worked very hard to make his paintings look easy. The water lily paintings, many of them have 15 layers of paint. And so he thought and rethought and rethought again what he was working on. And one of his best friends who saw him paint many times, a writer named Octave Mirbeau, who I discuss in the book, described how Monet could spend 60 sessions on a single painting. So if we add that up, that probably would amount to about a month's work on a painting. He was incredibly prolific and painted thousands of works in the course of his long career, his very long painting career. He lived to the age of 86 and painted almost until the end. But there was great craftsmanship in the way he worked, and his brushstrokes, every brushstroke counted, and he knew how to make them count. He knew how to sculpt with paint. He knew how to use the warp and weft of the canvas in order to give the shimmering effect that he wanted to create on so many of these canvases.
Let's get to his fascination, even obsession, with water lilies. The critic, is it Louis Gelée?
That's right.
A friend of Monet's, writes metaphorically that the lily pond, which he constructed in his garden, was the, quote, nymph with whom Monet was in love. How, tell us about that, and also how water nymphs are associated with lilies.
Right. Well, it's a very funny question. People always claim to see women in these paintings because, and it's almost like they're seeing an after image of paintings done in the middle part of the 19th century, which always had naked women wading in the water among water lilies and in mythological scenes such as the death of Hylas, which I discuss in the book, etc. But it was love at first sight for Monet. I think I would discount most of these stories about women appearing in the paintings, although they're quite funny. But it was love at first sight. In 1889, Monet saw water lilies with colored flowers for the first time at the World Expo, the Universal Exposition in Paris, the exposition for which the Eiffel Tower was constructed.
Mm. And he imported water lilies for this garden.
That's right.
Not making a whole lot of friends among the locals along the way.
Well, because if you think about it, what Monet began doing was he got these cultivars, water lilies that were a cross between the hardy French variety, which only had white flowers, and these exotic specimens from Mesoamerica, which had much more colorful flowers. And that was what Monet really wanted, and that's what he put in his garden. But, of course, the locals in Giverny had never seen these things before, and they used the water. I mean, Monet had diverted a river and created his pond out of it. And so the water lilies need flowing water, and so the water flowed through his pond and to where they washed their clothing and watered their cattle. And the locals were concerned, you know, who were old-time countrymen, and they were absolutely convinced that Monet was going to kill their cattle or something or destroy the countryside.
More on Monet and water lilies, and we'll get to the grand decoration shortly here on Radio Times. Our guest is Ross King. His new book is Mad Enchantment, and if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499 or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. More just ahead. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and in studio with us, Ross King, who is the author of Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. And again, lines are open at 888-477-9499. And going into the break, we were talking about Monet and his fascination with water lilies. And this all leads to the grand decoration. But just a little bit more, if you would, on the cultural obsession, fascination with this plant at the time. If you could read a passage from
sure.
the book.
This is what water lilies probably meant to Monet, or partly meant to Monet and his viewers, the people who saw his paintings. Appearing by the dozen in poems and paintings, they evoked the mysterious and the unknown, the feminine, the oriental, the exotic, voluptuous, and often, at the same time, the sinister, deathly, and gruesome. The botanical characteristics of the water lily were helpfully explained by Monet's son-in-law, Jean-Pierre Ochetet, a stickler for horticultural detail. Everyone thinks that Monet sowed his water lilies, he wrote, when in fact they were planted. Many have said that these plants floated. This is an error. water lilies root in the mud at the bottom of the water, producing long petioles and peduncles, which rise to the air at the surface, the perioles giving birth to the leaves that spread in a circle on the water, and the peduncles to the large flowers. He pointed out that water lilies lived in stagnant water such as bogs and ponds. Anchored in the mud, their beautiful blossoms floating on stagnant waters, such characteristics were bound to attract symbolic meanings. For the poet and playwright Maurice Maeterlinck, water lilies were the primordial plants, the original inhabitants of the ooze and mud. For the novelist George Sand, they were an emblem of fragile innocence blooming in a foul and dank environment. In her preface to the novel François Le Champy, first serialized in 1848, she described how her inspiration for the novel came from seeing, in a city she does not identify, a poor boy in a street known as the Chemin aux Nappes, an ugly and dangerous dead end bordered by a ditch where in the muddy water, amid salamanders and snakes, grow the most beautiful water lilies in the world, whiter than camellias, more fragrant than lilies, purer than a virgin's dress. These plants were, she wrote, the wild and admirable vegetation of the sewer. The image of virgins and sewers was repeated a few years later by a French theologian who argued that the water lily, with its white flower rooted in the mud, symbolized the Virgin Mary because of her obscure origins in the hinterlands of Nazareth. For other writers, the muddy ponds in which water lilies flourished gave them more ominous connotations. For Monet's doomed, demented friend, the poet Maurice Rollinat, a stagnant pond was always a source of suspicion and anxiety. One of his poems evoked a black bog, sinister and fearful, lit by hobgoblins in which the moon's reflection looked like a skull and crossbones. The murky waters in which they thrived therefore gave water lilies not a miraculous purity and chaste innocence, but rather more than a hint of menace. One of his prose pieces, The Red Pond, described monstrous water lilies with blossoms of mortuary white, masking the perfidy of the deep and floating on the dark water like decomposing hearts. And I go on in the passage after to describe an even more disturbing vision of water lilies given by Monet's friend Octave Mirbeau in a book called The Torture Garden, which I think I shall spare. on a lovely Tuesday morning, I'll spare your listeners what exactly goes on in that novel, but it's
sure.
it's very grisly.
Well, is there anything like this as a symbol in contemporary art?
Oh, good question. And I suppose one of the questions I would, and I'm not sure I can answer that question. And the other question I probably can answer is, if today we still have those same connotations to them, or has Monet, with these beautiful visions of his paintings, and it's an open question how much of it he knew. He certainly knew what Rollinat wrote about them and what Mirbeau wrote about them. And they're in some ways riffing on his garden itself, because The Torture Garden, the novel by Mirbeau, in many ways is a grim, grisly reflection of Monet's garden. His novel was inspired by Monet's garden.
But were there these dark notes in Monet's works?
Well, that's a question that I think we have to ask ourselves when we look at these paintings, because Monet himself said he wanted his works to be part of an asylum of peaceful meditation. He wanted us to look at his works and be overcome by calm and be soothed by them and have a kind of beautiful balm from the paintings. However, I think many of them are quite disturbing, especially possibly ones with the weeping willows in, which I discuss in the book in terms of the connotations of the war that we see in that.
They were also symbolic at that time,
absolutely.
Much more so, I think, than they are today.
That's right, a symbol of mourning. And in some ways, maybe what Monet has done with water lilies is taken away this mystique that they had in late 19th century France, when they were voluptuous and exotic, and he has maybe in some ways sanitized them and made them part of this beautiful scene in the French countryside, because they were, as his neighbor objected, they were foreign, they were an import, they were something very different, which had been brought into a context in which, where people were not familiar with them.
So let's get to the grand decoration. Describe the vision, if you would, and how it came about. Was it Monet's idea or was it Clemenceau's?
Originally, it was Monet's. As early as the late 1890s, soon after he began building his, or constructing, excavating his Water Lily Garden, he talked about how his ultimate ambition was to decorate a room with water lilies. He wanted to...
He wanted the viewer to be immersed.
That's right.
In this
we would now call it an immersive experience. We'd say what he's creating is an, or what he wanted to create was an installation that would give the viewer a fuller sense, an immersive experience, a fuller sensory experience than just framed paintings on the wall. He really wanted these works to become part of the architecture of a room, and you would move into it and sort of have experienced vicariously the beauty of his water lily garden at different times of the day and in different points during the year. So he first started talking about that in the late 1890s, but it was really more than a decade before he decided that he was going to carry forth his plan. He did a lot of water lily paintings in between, during, especially between 1903 and 8. All of them sold. They couldn't be kept together as part of a kind of national collection or as a part of a Musée Claude Monet, which really is what he wanted these to form. And so it was really only in 1914 that he went back to work trying to create what he quickly began calling his great decoration, the grand decoration. Yeah.
Give us a sense of the size.
They're enormous. I'm sure many of your listeners have seen the ones, for example, at the composition at the Carnegie or the one at MoMA. They're 6.5 feet high by the one in the Carnegie is almost 20 feet wide. The one at MoMA is over 40 feet wide. They're massive compositions. And so when we think of Impressionism, we often, I think, quite rightly think of canvases maybe 3 feet wide by 2.5 feet high, which is what Monet had painted for much of his career. But suddenly in 1914, for a variety of reasons, part of which was his eyesight, he supersized his canvases. He began working on a much, much larger scale.
He had cataracts.
That's right. He was diagnosed with cataracts in 1912. And one way he dealt with them was to use large canvases. In 1919, he tried to paint small again, tried 3-foot-wide, 4-foot-wide canvases, using a much more meticulous, smaller brushstroke, smaller brushes, and found that his eyesight and possibly also his motor coordination, because he was almost 80 at that point and did have some what would probably be diagnosed today as rheumatoid arthritis, which he blamed on painting in the open air all the time.
Although he was inside sometimes.
No, he was inside a lot. That's one of the other myths of Monet. If you asked him where his studio was, he would gesture at the open air and say, "This is my studio. Nature is my studio." But in fact, he had, by 1915, the largest studio in the history of art, this enormous, this cavernous structure that is looks like and is almost as large as an airplane hangar. Which
this was to house his this project,
that's
this
right.
monumental project.
That's right.
This is also unfolding at the same time as World War One. France is becoming embroiled in
that's
World
right.
War One. Now, how does this affect Monet and his work?
In some ways, not a lot, because he kept painting. The terrible irony for Monet is he had stopped painting because of the cataracts and the death of his wife, Elise, in 1911. He stopped for a couple of years, finally got back working in the spring of 1914 and decided he was going to carry through his plan to create this installation of water lilies. He didn't know where it was going to go yet, but he was going to do it sort of on spec. And tragically for him, and for the rest of the world, the war started at that point, of course, in the summer of 1914. And Monet did stop painting briefly, but then he began painting frantically, passionately, unstoppably through the war years. And by the summer of 1915, before the war was even a year old, he had done so much work that he needed this larger studio to be built.
Now, he did fare fairly well. The rest of the French, many of the French, were suffering because they were chopping furniture.
That's right.
For
yes,
heat,
yes.
Because of his friendship with Clemenceau, Georges Clemenceau.
That's right.
You actually write that, talking about the accoutrements that he required to work well, you write that Monet, without a regular supply of cigarettes, did not bear contemplation.
Yes, exactly. Monet painted maniacally and he smoked maniacally. Mm. He loved to smoke. And I often think that if conservatives looked for it, or while they're cleaning a Monet painting, they could probably find cigarette ash in it, because he did not paint without a cigarette in his mouth or cigarette in his hand. And so when the in 1917, when tobacco for civilians was cut back severely, as was wine, the two of his favorite things in life, when they were cut back, Monet was nicotine starved and deprived of his daily bottle of wine, and so he was he went through all sorts of machinations to try to get it. He would write to people and say, does your chauffeur know where I can get some cigarettes? In other words, is there a black market? Can you tap into a black market for me and get me some cigarettes? And so, but more seriously, he was affected by his, or adversely affected by the inability to get pigments, get paint, get canvas, all of which, for reasons I described, were part of the war effort, because the camoufleurs were making fake trenches, a fake Paris in the middle of the countryside, north to the northwest of Paris, to try to fool the Germans to bomb this simulacrum of Paris rather than the real thing. And so paint and pigment were part of the war effort, and so Monet really had to fight to get his supply of them.
Let's talk a little bit more about color in relation to his eyesight. As the cataracts grew worse, how did this affect the way he saw color, if at all?
Very adversely. If you see any of the works that he did in 1922 or 1923, his color balance clearly has been disturbed. And he takes his garden, his beautiful garden at Giverny, which has all of its nuances of blue flowers and green foliage, and he turns it into a kind of apocalyptic vision where there are hot sulfurs, sulfurous yellows, blood reds, things like that, and he almost scrawls with his brush on the canvas. Those paintings are actually enormously exciting.
And I was just going to say, how are they regarded?
For a long time, they were regarded as artistic mistakes, and people said his eyesight wasn't working properly, which I think certainly was the case. But the key thing is Monet destroyed so much of his work, but he did not destroy those paintings. He kept them, so he obviously thought there was some worth to them.
When you hear that he destroyed his work, or you in your research you determine this with the knife or however he did you think, what a waste?
Yeah, and people thought
that. What did he destroy?
People thought that at the time. And in fact, in 1907, when he was having great difficulties with the first water lily paintings he was doing and really making himself ill, he was having psychosomatic illnesses throughout this time. He destroyed 35 paintings in one morning. And when a Chicago newspaper heard about this, he was very popular in Chicago. And when the newspaper found out about this, they said, is he a madman or a genius? And they thought he was a complete fool. They calculated he'd destroyed $100,000 worth of paintings that morning, which today probably amounts to, it would have been, with a painting having sold for $80 million last week, I'm sure, you know, he destroyed $1 billion worth of painting that morning. And his friends were very upset by this, by the tempers that he flew into and by these destructive rages, because they believed, many of them, that the paintings he was destroying were actually worthwhile. And Georges Clemenceau would sometimes fight Monet to preserve them. And Monet's self-portrait, which is in the Musée d'Orsay right now, was going to be consigned to the flames, but Clemenceau managed to wrest it out of Monet's arms and take it home with himself and preserve it.
An interesting pair of friends, Monet and Clemenceau. Clemenceau used to call him the old crustacean?
That's right. He'd write, dear old crustacean, dear old lunatic, he called him. Or my favorite, he would call him the abominable hedgehog. And Clemenceau's nickname, which Monet never called him, was the tiger. Mm. Everyone else called him that, and that because he was such a fearsome figure. Everyone was terrified of him.
I want to get to one tweet from Martino, and I'm not sure if you have that information. What was Claude Monet's favorite color? Did he have one?
Good question. And I think if he were sitting here, he would probably say violet, because he made a eureka discovery one day when he said that, I've discovered the color of the atmosphere. It's violet. Because, of course, Monet said he didn't just want to paint things, i.e. the physical objects like the haystacks or the cliffs or the reflections in the pond. He wanted to paint what was between himself and these reflections, or between himself and the cathedral facade in Rouen, things like. He wanted to paint the air. And he believed, I suppose with this preternaturally good eyesight, that what he saw was violet colors enveloping everything.
Well, and as a matter of fact, you write that much of Monet's life and work had been a mad striving for the impossible, to paint his carefully chosen object under singular and fleeting conditions of weather and light. And he even admits, "I'm chasing a dream. I want the impossible."
And that's why he flew into such terrible rages, because what he was trying to do was capture and freeze an image that lasted only for a second, and he wanted to preserve it. The light changed, he said, every 7 minutes, and therefore he wanted to have a painting for every 7 minutes of the day and every 7 minutes of every day in every season and every year. And so he was trying to really capture all of these things that are transient and impalpable. Because if you think of what he was painting, the water lilies, he's painting reflections of clouds. He's painting a reflection of something that in itself is impalpable. He's painting the sunlight. He's painting the haze of the atmosphere between himself and the pond. And these things were shifting and changing, and it would drive him into terrible rages. One of my favorite stories about him is how he flew into a rage on the north coast of France in the English Channel when the tide wasn't behaving as he wanted it to, because and that was nature by definition.
Nature has a way of doing that.
Exactly, and his project was bound to fail, and I think that's what where his frustration came from, that his reach was always exceeding his grasp and always going to, and he would just try to raise himself up to the point where he could just in pigment, in something as dense as the pigments he used, capture and freeze these split seconds in time.
So we're up against a break, but quickly, how many panels did he end up choosing for the grand decoration?
Oh, originally it was going to be 2, and then it became 12. And then finally, after he died, because they only left his home after he died, there were 22.
And we're talking about close to 350 feet.
That's right.
Massive. Of art.
Yes.
Okay. More in just a moment. We're talking to Ross King, who is the author of Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. We've got some telephone calls coming in now to 888-477-9499. We'll get to those in just a moment. More of Radio Times continues here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and Ross King is with us in studio. He is the author of Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. And again, calls coming in to 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So the grand decoration, this Water Lily series, was intended originally or as a gift France?
Who knows what Monet was originally envisaging as he was
that he agrees to it.
Ultimately, yes.
And it's
after
tough
he'd
for
been
him to
painting
let
for
go.
About 4 years, he decided, aha, he had a eureka moment. Mm-hmm. What I'll do with these, he'd done probably about 100 paintings at this point over the course of the war, and he, without any idea what he was going to do with it. And so at the armistice, he decided that what he would do would be to donate 2 of the paintings to France and have Clemenceau, who was prime minister, come and choose them and offer them to the state on his behalf. Clemenceau then came to Giverny, as he often did, but he had not been able to during the war years. He finally came and he saw these acres of canvas that Monet had covered. And I think he decided, why stop at 2? Why don't we supersize the donation and make a much larger one? And so on Monet's 80th birthday, 1920, they said there were going to be 12 of them. And then ultimately 22 canvases went into this purpose-built structure, this purposely adapted structure.
The orangerie.
Which finally opened in 1927, the 2 elliptical rooms. Monet was very expressly wanted to have these elliptical rooms in which to show his work. And so finally the world got to see what he had been working on for the better part of a decade, for about a dozen years. And oddly, I think maybe surprisingly for us, the reviews were bad. Monet had enjoyed good reviews for the last 40 or so years, but after his death, the knives came out and people said, these are a mistake, it's the work of an old man. I think they were not prepared for canvases that size, ones that didn't have much structure to them, because he was painting, as I was saying, water, reflections, light. And I think there was a kind of craving, maybe an understandable craving, for certainty in the years after the war, the sort of hard edges and firm geometry of cubism seemed to offer a slightly more stable place in the world than Monet's very amorphous, vaporous, dreamlike scenes of his water lily garden. He was out of step by that point with artistic taste. And it really took another generation who came along after World War II to appreciate his work and to celebrate it. And suddenly, the Orangerie was known as the Sistine Chapel of Impressionism, mm-hmm. and one of the summits of French genius, etc. And so finally, it took time, but it finally did receive its due.
It was difficult, though, even though Monet had made that commitment to give this art up.
The odd thing about Monet, I mean, there were a lot of odd things about him. He's a lovable, but also frustrating character. He finally had his dream within his grasp by 1920, 1921, when the donation was being finalized, the documents were being drawn up, the French state was going to pay for everything, and they were going to give him a huge whack of money himself for one of his other paintings. Everything was going very well, but Monet then began sabotaging the donation. He wasn't happy with anything. He wasn't happy with the space they were preparing for him. And crucially, he wasn't happy with his paintings because he was beginning to suffer even more adversely from cataracts at that point. And he told Clemenceau at one point, one of my favorite quotes from Monet, he said, "I shall be able to bear their imperfections only when I'm dead." And so while living, he couldn't bear in many ways to think of all posterity looking at these works and judging them as perhaps he had an intimation of judging them very harshly at first.
Is it true that there's actually a gash in one of these panels?
Yes.
Inflicted by Monet?
Well, he inflicted gashes on many of his works, which sadly no longer exist. The gash that you can just make out on one of the paintings was caused by a bomb in 1944 because a bomb came through the orangery. Monet did slash one, and Clemenceau said that you can still see it, but it's either been repaired extremely well, or Monet has, or Clemenceau was exaggerating things. I've not been able to see that one, but it is a Clemenceau claimed in 1927 that if you looked very close, you could see the effects of one of Monet's rages. And I'm not sure if it was just repaired. And that's a very likely story, but it may have been repaired since then. So it's no longer visible, alas, because in some ways it's a nice testament to the sort of the tempestuous, obstreperous character that Monet truly was.
Any idea of the value of the grand decoration?
Well,
today?
I mean, it's probably absolutely impossible to say because one of the grain stack or haystack paintings went last week for $80 million and broke Monet's record, which previously in 2008 had been set by one of the small water lily paintings. But if one of the, say, 40 foot wide or even 14 foot wide, 6 foot 6 inches high paintings came on the market, it's almost it boggles the mind as to what that would, what sort of a price that would command. There aren't all that many of them. I mean, there are 41 that still exist, many in public collections. And at the end of the book, I've got a kind of guide or glossary so that you can use to see where you can see all of these paintings. It's impossible to say, but it certainly would break Monet's record, if not possibly the Jeff Koons and Jackson Pollock and break their records as well.
All right, to the phones we go. Louise in Anaristown, you are live on Radio Time for this. Hi, Louise.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
The reason I'm calling is I'm a member of the Art Goes to School program that's sponsored by the Philadelphia Museum of Art that takes artwork into the classroom, and I just wondered what your guest would want children to know about Monet.
Interesting question.
Oh, very good. And I've done a number of talks on Monet for students. I think one of the things I would say about him is that is really what I say about all of the painters that I work on, whether it's Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo or even figures in literature and politics like Niccolo Machiavelli. What I try to stress in all of my books is the way in which they overcame adversity, because all of them, if you reverse engineer their works of art, You might think that, of course, they were always, they're geniuses. Leonardo da Vinci, how could he fail? Michelangelo, how could he fail? Claude Monet, how could he not do something that's absolutely wonderful? And yet they were full of self-doubt and uncertainty. Students, I give a talk about the adolescent Leonardo da Vinci and what he was like as an adolescent and what we know about his adolescence and how he wasn't all-conquering. Everyone recognized how brilliant he was, but he had yet to find his way in the world. And so I think I would just underline that for Monet as well, that he had his many struggles and he overcame them. And I think his work was great because of the fact that he overcame them.
All right. Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Louise. Speaking of adversity, you write in your book about the cataract surgery that was performed in the early 20th century.
Right.
And as we were saying off mic, it makes you glad that we live in 2016.
That's right. Those passages
are.
I was a bit weak at the knees when I had to write those passages because it was a very gruesome business. And poor Monet had to lie absolutely still for weeks on end in his hospital bed with his eyes
covered. Cocaine was the anesthesia?
Cocaine was the anesthesia. And it was said if you were a heavy drinker, you would sometimes hallucinate. And Monet was quite a heavy drinker and I think had difficulties. And they didn't station a guard by his bed, as was often done when they gave the patients cocaine as the anesthetic. And he did have a terrible time, and he tried to rip the bandages off and things like that. And sadly, the cataract surgery wasn't really effective. Now I think it's almost 100% effective. But he, and I've known many people who've had it, and it seems a very simple operation today. But for Monet, it was a major operation with no guaranteed outcome of success.
Right. I'd like to get to some comments. Just read them quickly. An email from Joseph who says, for years, I was a tour guide in New York City. I often went into the MoMA to sit in front of the water lilies and relax, meditate, and get myself together while my tour group had free time on Fifth Avenue. Also a tweet from Dominic who says, I've considered the time symbology of the lilies, more on the control of nature and dominance over the wild transition. And for an email from Anne, it says, I wonder if poor vision might have inspired Impressionism.
There are theories. I mean, many of the Impressionists did have eye problems. I think and people have put forth that theory. And you could argue, I think, that Monet using the larger canvases was because of his eyesight. And so in some ways, modern art was kickstarted in huge canvases of all over painting. What became the 20th century, landmark 20th century art. In some ways, that all began because of Monet's eye problems 25 years earlier. I think the problem with the theory about Impressionism and eye problems is that the painters had reached their mature styles or reached the Impressionist style in the 1860s before they were having eye problems. Edgar Degas certainly was having eye problems by the 1870s and 1880s, but he doesn't really paint in that kind of flickering style that Monet does. But it's a very interesting concept, and it's not for nothing that ophthalmologists are very interested in Monet and Impressionist paintings, because I think there is a lot to learn.
Well, you know, it's interesting, too. You write about the early critics of Impressionist work and how people finally learned how to view it.
That's right. Yes. Things like the viewing distance, which,
yes.
I mean, Camille
Pizarro.
How did
they calculate that?
Well, there was, in the 1880s, there was a rage for making art scientific under people like Georges Seurat, the pointillist painters. And they came up with a formula whereby you measured the canvas from diagonally from corner to corner and then multiplied that by three. And that was the ideal viewing distance of it. And I've, with Seurat's paintings in the National Gallery in London, I've tried that experiment, and I'm not sure it... they do look good from that distance, but they also look good from farther back and from closer up. And they look most fascinating, of course, from about six or eight inches away when you can see the way in which he's adding his dots to the paintings.
Mm. So at one point, as Monet is approaching the age of 80, he finds himself alone, I guess, in his group of peers, a survivor of the period's impressionist artists. Tell us about what Renoir meant to Claude Monet and of Renoir's death.
They were very good friends. And it's interesting that Renoir had moved to the south of France and he lived near Nice. And so Monet didn't see a lot of him in the last decade or two of his life. but he always wrote to him very affectionate letters, and Renoir would come to see him when he came to Paris. And it's interesting that in 1914, when war broke out, Monet's first thoughts, apart from his family, because his son and his stepchildren would both become part of the war effort, all three of them would go to the Western Front. But his first thoughts outside of his family were for Renoir, and he wrote asking for news of Renoir, because Renoir had sons who went into uniform as well. And so when Renoir died after the war in 1919, Monet was devastated, because he was devastated by a number of deaths in those years, Mirbeau in 1917, Rodin the same year. But Renoir, I think, struck him particularly hard because he'd known Renoir since he was a very young man. He'd known him, effectively 60 years, and it was a very, very close friendship, very affectionate. And he admired Renoir enormously because of the way in which he carried on. I was talking about Monet's adversity, but Renoir also had his adversity, which was terrible, terrible arthritis, which turned his hands into claws. And some of your viewers might have seen, and you can go on the internet and see some of the films of this, Renoir painting with his paintbrush actually tied with ribbons to his hands so that he can hold it and manipulate it. And Renoir sort of went on uncomplainingly. And Monet saw him as a great exemplar, someone whose example he would try to follow. And so when Renoir died, a huge part of Monet's past fell away, and Monet became literally the last of the Impressionists. He lived another 7 years as the last remaining member of this group that had completely upset the apple cart of French art, of world art, and began painting in this exciting new style.
Yeah. Well, and when he does pass away at the age of 86 from lung cancer, you write that he died in his bedroom in the museum of his admired companions.
That's right. He bought paintings from many of his friends. He had Renoirs. He had 14 Cézannes. No one bought Cézanne's paintings in the 1880s and 1890s, but Monet did. Monet admired Cézanne so much and found his painting so good. When his own work wasn't going well, his wife would come and discreetly drape the Cézanne so that Monet didn't have these images of perfection reproving him from his walls. But I think it's a lovely image that he had in his bedroom, which you can visit today in Giverny. He had all of these paintings, paintings by Edouard Manet, paintings by Renoir, Cézanne, bust by Auguste Rodin, all of them in his bedroom. And it's nice to think that all of them had predeceased him, but he nevertheless did die among them.
What an extraordinary vision that bedroom must have been
for him. Yes.
So as we draw to the close of the hour, tell us a little bit about the journey you took in writing this book.
Oh, well, it was sheer pleasure, I have to admit. It was 3 years of pleasure. I was very sad when it ended. I was very sad when Monet died. I got quite choked up when I had to effectively kill him off in the book, because everyone else I've written about, Leonardo, Michelangelo, they all died decades after the point where I'm writing about, because I take confined periods in their life. But this was the last 12 years in the life of Claude Monet, so I had to kill him off. But it was just sheer pleasure writing the book because of the fact that I was able to delve into his life and time so deeply.
Did you
so
travel
deeply.
Extensively?
I went to Paris many times, obviously. I went to Giverny, which is always wonderful to go to. It was a complete indulgence. Great pleasure.
Well, Ross King, it was a pleasure having you with us for
this hour
of Radio Times. And again, Ross King's newest work is Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. And he will be at the Philadelphia Free Library tonight at 7:30. Remember, if you have a moment, visit our Facebook page and take a listen to our podcast. You'll find it all at whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.